From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 17, Episode 16, The Best Story Wins. This week, we heard the prosecutor's closing arguments and the story that ultimately led to Chris Bynum's conviction on this quintuple homicide. This week, the whole crew is here. Janet is back from her assignment, joining Bob and I, and we are all here to discuss your listener questions and theories. But before we get into that, do we have any housekeeping?
We do. I was just discussing this before we went live that I can't give you guys some real specifics about this. This is what I know that you guys need to know. We're going to be off during Thanksgiving. I don't know what that looks like as far as which dates we're off. It gets really confusing. You wouldn't think it is, but it's actually pretty confusing because of the episodes on Sunday and the episodes on Friday and the days we record and when people are going to be traveling and how all that's going to shake out. So it may be we might have an episode on the Sunday. I'm thinking it'll be we'll have an episode on the Sunday before Thanksgiving, and then we won't have the next episode will be the follow-up to that episode, which will be a week later, I think is probably how it'll shake out. That way we don't have to record a follow-up when everybody's traveling for Thanksgiving and do a main episode over that weekend and all that stuff. So I think that's what it's going to look like, but I got to look at the calendar to figure it all out. Just know we have a week off coming up for the Thanksgiving holiday.
Just know. We don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. I thought about it like right before we started recording. I'm like, oh, yeah, I got to tell them about the week off for Thanksgiving. And without a calendar in front of me, I don't remember what day that's going to be. But yeah, there'll just be one day you'll tune in for an episode and there won't be one. But we'll be back.
Great.
And like Zach said, Janet is back from her assignment. And we're going to be obviously breaking down the state's case against Chris. These episodes are tricky for me when I actually get myself a couple episodes ahead. I'm trying to remember what I talked about this week and what you guys haven't heard yet. This was all about the state's closing argument. We talked about this a bit last week, but for me, it was just extra shocking to me to realize that that's all there was. That was the end of it. And that even when the state's narrative, everything they're telling you happened, they're just doing nothing but leaning on Chris's confession, which is so full of holes, it's insane how many and how many inaccuracies and things are on it. So I want to hear what you two think about it before we get into the questions. And Jan, if you have any, we'll start with you because you've also missed the last 2 weeks where you were out working. If there's anything you want to bring up or bring back to the forefront from the other couple of episodes, you can that's fine to do that too.
My main takeaway from I think the very last follow-up was how envious I was that you two were going to hit the road and do a little boots on the ground work. So,
which we haven't done yet.
You haven't done yet.
It's still coming. Yeah, we're trying to work out some scheduling things, not
copy
with us.
That.
With, yeah, that haven't shaken out yet. But yeah, that's coming.
But yeah, I mean, I think everything that I would have said or that I would react to in the last couple of episodes still holds true for this episode since they're kind of a piece. I mean, certainly talking about Donald's participation, what he was there to talk about and what was very specifically and carefully left out of trial testimony and stuff. I mean, the listeners and Zach, you know, you guys covered it all. I mean, I think what's hard about this is that we talk a lot about, and I understand that, you know, a lot of really good work is done and most of the time people are guilty and they go away, but unfortunately, every time we do one more of these, it feels like that's one more in the pile. And you know that there's just like a giant forest of trees of the same problem standing behind every one of these wrongful convictions. So when there are certain motifs that keep coming back, it's just discouraging. It just feels very discouraging about the legal system when you start to feel like you're seeing the kind of machinations of like, well, if I just ask the question this way, then I don't have to worry about the obvious glaring problem with this evidence that I can just sweep under the rug by not saying this one word or not addressing it in a certain way. That's just
or not putting a certain person on the stand.
Or not putting a certain person on the stand. It just feels it just feels like dirty pool over and over and over again. And it's just really hard not to feel like if you're taking the time and care to make sure to avoid those things, it really feels like, you know, this person isn't responsible. And sometimes the only quote unquote comfort, and it is cold comfort indeed, but cold comfort that we get is like, well, I think this person really thinks that this person did it. Like, you know, at least the cop really thought this person was responsible, even though they were dead wrong. And like their logic was, and it was confirmation bias and all this. But when you get into this territory of like, they had to know that, you know, that it wasn't him. It's so incredibly scary and sad and hard.
To me, the note that we were talking about last week is the biggest indication to me that.
Yeah, that was a huge moment for you guys.
I can't give him that benefit of the doubt, even besides what we kind of figured out. And I know there's a question about it, so I'll wait to get into some of those specifics. But even without what we went through with it, with the Star 69 stuff on there, just the fact that they're saying we have a note, it's attached, and then the note doesn't show up at trial, and then they dance around it the way that they do, like, tells me that, one, that note didn't say what they said it said, and two, that means they know that it wasn't Chris Bynum.
No, I mean, the pages where it's like everything signed except that one sheet and all of that is just, as some people would say, really hinky. It's goofy.
Yeah.
It's weird. It's very suspicious. If the shoe were on the other foot, and that was the kind of evidence that, you know, if there was whatever the criminal equivalent of that is, if it were like evidence being used against a person on trial, that you that would be like your golden thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You would be like, look at this. You don't think this person's guilty? Look, on this page, it's signed by blah, blah, blah. On the third page, it's signed, and on the fourth page, it's signed. But the second page, no signature in sight. And that's where the most important information is, ladies and gentlemen. I ask you, use your logic. We ask you to use your basic common sense, which is another argument that gets made. You know, it feels like it's coming off a script. This idea of like, listen to what the people who listen to what they're telling you. They're telling you this. They're telling you that. It's like, okay, that's like, you know, like closing statement 101 for when you don't maybe have much.
Yeah, which they didn't.
Yeah.
They didn't have it. I also wanted to address something a little bit because I kind of picked up on it kind of after I recorded the episode you're going to hear on Sunday. So I just want to point out when you mentioned Detective Donald, you got a little bit, and I shared a little bit during that episode, which was a couple episodes ago, that you definitely heard his kind of attitude coming out during like the bench conference when when the jury stepped aside and then all of a sudden he started being real shitty to Graddick. But it seems like it's hard to read from the transcript, but we pick up in the defense closing argument, which you're going to hear on Sunday, that it sounds like he was being very
hostile?
Obstinate, yeah. aggressive, hostile during his questioning, because Graddick mentions that a lot in his closing argument about the way that he was acting on the stand, which makes sense to me too. When you hear, again, like Chris's, you know, read through his PCR testimony, he talks about what that whole process was like. He comes across like cocky, arrogant
bully.
Asshole is the way it reads. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think for me too, I think a lot of this comes with the benefit of hindsight. We're able to look at what we now know, which is important. But I tried to look at this episode as in real time, as in the jury, we know. And do I, you know, with hindsight, do I think Chris is innocent? Most likely, I think Chris is innocent, right? But based on what we heard and based on the story and based on the lack of the defense doing anything, I understand why the jury found him guilty.
Yeah,
for sure.
I will say this, because the one thing that the piece of the puzzle you guys are missing that you're going to get on Sunday is, you know, we got to the end of the state's case and then we heard the state's closing argument. But in between there was the defense. And to me, if the jury was paying attention, the defense really, like the jury should have, like, I don't think he did a fantastic job. I think he definitely missed the mark on a lot of cross-examinations. He was also handcuffed pretty badly by them, certain witnesses, they can't find him. You know, Dame's not available. We just can't find him anywhere. And sadly, no one can talk about what he said in his report. That kind of shit. So he was kind of handcuffed by that. He definitely, I think, he missed the mark on cross-examining a few people. I agree. And when Dr. Jackson said that there were perhaps some mental decline going on during that, I think when you hear his full closing argument, that, to me, you see that. I think it's there. I think there was something going on. It's very, like, even when I was, like, reading it and analyzing it and then even speaking it, I'm just like, what are you saying? Like, I don't. But that being said, he did, in the defense case in chief, which was really short, you'll hear that too Sunday, he took some shots that should have put in the jury's mind when they heard what you heard here, where you're like, well, they're saying, you know, obviously he confessed, he said this. He does shoot some holes in that that apparently the jury didn't catch or just didn't find.
Well, it's just so damning when you hear that Larry says it's Chris,
yeah, right?
In hindsight, we know what we know now, but at the time, Larry says it's Chris.
Right.
We have this confession. We have the firearms expert saying these bullets match, and in Chris's confession, he has this firearm.
Right.
Those are hard things to overcome without the true evidence in front of you.
But, yeah, especially the way that Miss Benjamin was the one that was doing the closing for the state. The way she phrased it, I remember when I was reading it, I was like, liar! And then I saw, like, the next sentence, because, you know, she says, and we know that Chris Bynum had a .38 caliber revolver. I'm like, what are you talking about? That was never proven.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's like, and we know that because he said it.
I mean, that was my written down question. This week I had my own little written down question, and it is calling back things that have come up from listeners in the past, and it's something that we've talked about. But I guess I just want to, like, see if we can sort of throw a lasso around it all together and kind of rope it in and maybe tie up kind of different pieces of what people have been asking for the last couple of weeks. So I said, in a situation where the most damning evidence, in my opinion, is the confession, what is usually done to combat this in a case? If you're not putting the defendant on the stand, do you bring in a third party to talk about false confessions? We've seen time and again that juries need a really compelling reason to throw away a confession, if they even will consider throwing away a confession in their mind when they're deliberating. What do you do? If somebody made a false confession, how do you address that in the trial in real time without putting the defendant on the stand?
That's a great question. And I really hadn't thought of, because we've said a few times, like, what are you going to do? Because if you put Chris on, then you're putting him to, you know, subjecting him to cross-examination. And the answer is exactly what you just said. Based on the other cases we've had, is you put a false confession expert on the stand. You know, think of, like, Jesse Miss Kelly. You know, that was the defense they tried to use against his, right? So that's typical. The problem I think that we had here, and again, this is where Graddick was really handcuffed, is you don't have a recorded confession for an expert witness to examine. You don't even have a actual transcript for an expert to examine. Because normally, yeah. So, and again, it goes back to the kind of chess game that the state played with this is, well, if we don't record it, we don't make a transcript, and we just type it and have them sign it, there's nothing they can do. There's nothing you can do other than put him on the stand and have him say, they forced me to do it, they threatened me, they did that, of which the jury, one, probably would, especially in the year 2000 or 2001, the jury probably wouldn't believe, because that was still at a time when, you know, there weren't podcasts and documentaries all explaining that false confessions and wrongful convictions do happen. And then they'll get destroyed on cross-examination. So like, that was the same thing, just like, ooh, we have this damning statement. So that, you know, they trap him with that, and then they're like, well, we have this damning statement in this report from Dame where Larry told him that he didn't recognize any of the voices. Well, what if we just can't find Dame? And then his report becomes hearsay, and then the jury never gets to hear that. You know, so it's like all, it's like such a wild game of chess, the way this was all manipulated. And that's where, you know, like what you had said earlier, Janet, like, you just want to believe that they just really thought that ends would justify the means, right? That, like, they have the right guy and they're just doing whatever they got to do to put the right person in prison. But I just don't buy it with this one. I think they knew damn well. They tried too hard to build a case out of nothing to think that they actually had the right person.
Yeah, Yeah. And again, you hear when you think about all the manipulation that goes into this. And again, you mentioned in the last follow up that there are these, you know, there's a reason that this case came from a similar and connected party as Jody's case, is that you see all of these things that are done seemingly to craft this way of convicting this person. And it's like, God, that's, you guys really used some cool skills to figure out how to do this. So I would love to see those skills put to work on examining the facts as they exist before you could arrest the wrong person. Why don't you use all those skills to actually find the responsible person?
What's frustrating is that there's a greater issue here to me, because I'm always trying to take a step back. I've talked about this many times before, and just kind of even when I was, you know, teaching personnel management, you know, when you're looking at any situation in order to properly correct it, I always use this diagram where it's like, so there's a consequence or something that happened that got your attention to this matter, and then that came from some kind of action. And most when we're talking in management, it's right. So people always want to correct the action. Don't do that again.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that never fixes the problem, because what you have to realize is that action came from a thought.
Yes.
That person had to think something in order to do that. So if you can try to figure out what the thought process was and correct the thought process, you're more likely to correct the problem and it won't happen further down the line. And if you go one step further, all those thoughts all come from some sort of core belief. There's some sort of core belief in this person is why they're thinking this way. So if you can really dig in and figure out that core belief, what the why is, then you can start to really correct. And that's how and the same approach can be used for systematic reform, like we're trying to do with the criminal justice system. And so in this case, I'm always looking at trying to get all the way back to that core belief. What is the why? What is the why going on here? And in my opinion, what I've identified is, my theorized is, their core belief is that these people don't matter, meaning the victims.
Yes.
Like Chris is a byproduct. They don't give a shit about him, but so we already know that. But it's a step further than that. You don't do all this to put the wrong person in prison for murdering five innocent people if you actually care about those five innocent people that died. Right. If you see them as human beings who deserve justice, you can't think that way. You can't think of ways to have the actions of doing things like lying about what was written on a note and not letting somebody have a lawyer, all these different things. The only core belief that I can come up with for that is that this set of officers, and even the prosecutors for that matter, when it comes down to it, just didn't see these victims as valuable. And that's what is the most tragic about all of this. And that's why, if you look at all the different corruption around this department around that time and all the different things that went on there, I think if you track it all back to, they see anybody that is maybe it's minority, maybe it's below the poverty line, maybe it's both, you know, with the socioeconomic group, or it could be a cultural thing or a drug thing or whatever it is, they're just like, it doesn't matter if we solve these crimes because these people are throwaways. So we just need to close cases. And that is what is the most sad about all of this.
Well, and then just to shoot it right back over to the closing argument then, that makes it 50 times more despicable that she uses those throwaways to play on the jury's emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Think about these poor people. They weren't even, no one was holding a weapon. They are calling out to you. They are calling out to you, jury, to give them justice. Listen to what they're telling you. Well, you didn't listen to what they were telling you.
No, you didn't.
Why
give
should
a shit
the jury do
them
any different?
That just actually made me even more sick.
It's despicable. You are using the people you don't care about to close your case and to get the wrong person in prison. Shame on you.
Well, and you know, they entered the confession, the second statement / confession that doesn't line up with that story.
Right.
You know what I mean? So that's a weird thing. Do you know what Chris was actually ultimately charged with? So was it first degree, second degree? Do we know?
First degree.
First degree?
Yeah.
Because I was thinking about that as I was listening, because the prosecutor says knowingly or intentionally killed.
Yeah, that's just the definition for okay. homicide. Yeah.
So I was curious because in the quote unquote confession, you know, it would have been more of like a second degree or a manslaughter. I know they were trying to push for like a self-defense, but it doesn't seem like it would be a first degree murder. There's no premeditation.
And I'll have to go through like the jury instructions and see if they, because it seems like if I remember correctly, they might have like gave him an option for a lesser charge. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's what he was
convicted
of.
But it seems like in her argument, that's kind of what she's saying. What she's saying is, my impression, and again, I could be totally wrong about this, but my takeaway was essentially her saying, like, sure, he tried to downplay it with his confession. Like, the reason that it's different, she didn't say this, but the implication is, the reason that his confession is different than the truth as we are presenting it to you is that he was trying to downplay his cold-blooded murder. He might have been trying to pretend like it was self-defense, but look at what we see from the evidence. No one was holding a weapon. He wasn't defending himself from anything. This was cold and calculated, and he was the only one in power with the ability to wreak havoc on these people's lives, and he took their lives. So please find him accountable for being a cold-blooded murderer, not a person who, like he claimed, was defending himself in some way.
And that's a death by a thousand cuts of all this, you know, even when it is recorded and they're using Reed technique where it's like, first, let me get you to admit you were there. Then let me get you to admit that maybe something. And then at some point you're like, okay, I agree. It happened and it was an accident. They got you because then all they have to do is that.
Right.
And then they just get all the way to the closing argument. We'd be like, obviously he's going to minimize his role. Yeah. He told you he was there. He told you he was killing him. Of course he's going to say it was self-defense, but we know it wasn't. And it just... Everything you think you're doing to try to hedge a little bit when you're in that position all falls apart in the closing argument.
Yep.
Did you have anything else you wanted to add, Zach, before we get into the listener questions?
I think that's all my notes from my phone.
Okay.
Okay, cool. Some of this is revisiting some of the pieces. And again, I think there are going to be some familiar themes here in large part because I think our listeners are continuing to, in some cases, as you'll see, continuing to say like, okay, but for reals, this is all there was? Or wait, you're really telling me? Like, did I miss something? Are you sure that they never followed up on XYZ? So if it feels like we're retreading a couple of things, I still think maybe it's worthwhile because there may be some lingering confusion or some just disbelief from folks who are like, seriously, you're telling me they never XYZ. So let's start with, I want to start with Sarah G, who posted, did Michelle, the friend who reported the note with a name, phone number, give the paper with a name number to the police? Okay, you addressed that in previous episodes and follow-ups. But Sarah says, it seems logical that the women would have taken the paper with them in case the person didn't show up. So I thought that was interesting, but I feel like the missing pieces.
Well, there's a time warp here.
Yeah.
So today, yes. Maybe. Well, I guess because it would be in your cell phone, but there was not a time of cell phone. So maybe. So the number that she wrote down, how did it work? She wrote down a number with a pager number on it.
I believe it was Chris's pager number.
Okay. And actually, let's unpack that even a little bit more now that I just thought about this. If she came there with the pager number, why did she then write the pager number down?
That is strange.
I don't know.
Because the story is she paged whoever Chris was.
Mm-hmm.
And then Chris called her back and she used the star 69 whatever to figure out what that number was when she called it back. But the number written down was supposed to be the pager number, which she didn't get from the, unless, I guess, I have to reread it. Did she say that she called? You know what? Now, as I'm saying that, didn't Michelle's statement say something along the lines that she called Amp and Amp gave him the number? Maybe that was it. I have to go back and look through. Maybe, Zach, if you can take a second and look through Michelle's statement. It's only a couple pages long. So maybe I didn't have a big revelation there.
Sarah's saying, if you know you're meeting someone and there's a chance that you won't connect with them and you want to be able to have that number so that maybe you're at a payphone and you can try calling that number to say, hey, we haven't met up. Where are you? Or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, it could make some sense, but it would be, you know, calling a pager from a payphone to have them call you back. I would assume, you know, back in that time when everybody's not so easily connected, You know, it was, if you said, I'm going to meet you there at the drugstore or at the liquor store, and I assume you just go to the liquor store. Apparently that's what happened. As far as the, and we have addressed this, but just to make crystal clear, as far as was the note collected, it says in the statement that it says, see attach. It says she showed him the paper note and he attached it to his report and then it disappeared. No one's ever seen it.
Also, just going back to what we were saying about how did it get written down and the pager number and all that kind of stuff.
I think Liz called Anthony and he gave her this pager number to write down. And she wrote it down at my house and then beeped him.
So
yes, she called Anthony. She called Amp to get the phone.
Okay, so now I'm confused and I'm so sorry, guys. I don't want to waste anyone's time. But now I'm confused about what the Star 16, why, so what's the Star 69?
The story is in that statement that Liz comes over, says, can I use your phone?
Yes.
She uses the phone, she calls Amp, and the way they're framing this is that she's trying to meet somebody to get some drugs.
Uh-huh.
And Amp says, call my boy Chris, here's his pager number. So then she hangs up, she writes down Chris and the number, then she pages that number with Michelle's phone number, waits a few minutes, the call comes in, she answers the call, and then leaves. And then the Star 69 is saying what number that call came from.
Which is not a thing.
Well, that's, so I'm gonna jump in. So whoever asked this question, we're gonna answer it here. But I did some more research because there were people on the Facebook page, several people actually, so it was Sue who said, how did the Star 69 statement get by everyone? So what I found from the research I've done after that episode is, that was a regional and by carrier thing, because there were a bunch of people. So somebody posted, they're like, dude, I use Star 69 and it would say the last number that called was this number. Press 1 if you want to call it back.
Oh, wow. That's not how it worked for me. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. That's not. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's,
and not, I was like, that's not how it worked, whatever looked. And so they had looked it up and found, and then I did some more deep research on it and found that it depended. Now, here where Zach and I lived, and apparently in was Arizona, Janet, where you lived, that's not, if you hit Star 69, it just called the number back.
Yeah. It still protects the privacy in some kind of way of the number that called you, because you can't just like get the number. It will just return the call in a sense.
Yes. But apparently some carriers in some regions, that's how it worked. Okay. It would be like the call back. So it would apparently be like a computer voice that would say the last number that called you was dot, 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 dot. Press 1 to call the number back or something like that. And then you can press it to call it back. So that, I don't know. I haven't been able to find a way. I've been trying to, and I don't know how to even go about it, but I've been trying through just internet searches to track down in the, you know, the landline carrier in Gary, Indiana, what it was. But I would assume that if that's in there, that problem, and it's an assumption and we don't want to make assumptions, you know, as far as like we were going to, but as far as the fact that they wrote that down in there, that it went that way, makes me think probably that was the case. Because that's as Sue had said, how did everyone miss that?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably why, because maybe it wasn't. Maybe the reason everyone missed it is because that is how it worked in Gary.
Okay. God, I still feel like I'm confused now. So
it confused me for the longest time, too. So it's essentially once she makes the page. So the first number she gives is this
Sheila.
Is the number. Liz.
Liz, not Michelle. Liz
gets the number. She writes it down and she calls that pager number.
Yes.
That's the one that's written down. And that's the one that is the same number on the report.
That is, quote unquote, attached to the report.
That is the same number that Chris gave in his statement as his pager number.
Okay.
So, but once she pages it, then you got to sit and wait. And then he called back from a phone. So that was the pager number, but he called back from some phone line somewhere.
Right.
And that is the number. They didn't know what it was, but she said she pressed Star 69 and it told him what number that incoming call came from. So where he called from.
And where, how was that used?
Well, it wasn't used at trial. And I have to remember now, too, because I was so caught up on the pager thing. If in the two statements, if Chris's home number matched up with that, because that would be wrong. That would be another glaring problem.
Because he wasn't there.
Because he wasn't home.
Yeah.
He was at, you know, to by their narrative, he's out with, you know, he's at the VFW somewhere, and somewhere close to where the liquor. So we need to chase that down too. But yeah, so that's, hopefully that clears that up for everybody. Cause it was, for me, it was confusing too. Cause first thing I was like, why is she pressing Star 69 on a pager number? But it wasn't, it was the number that called her back. But the bigger issue for me is, why didn't she sign that page, and why didn't the note make it to trial? Because like you said, you were going a different way with it, but there's no question here. If you go to trial and you're like, here's a note in Liz's handwriting that was, and you can see the other notes on there because it sounded like it was a page where Michelle already had a bunch of stuff written down on a note paper.
Oh, okay.
And here's where Liz writes in different handwriting. She writes the name Chris. There's Chris's number. That's who she was going to see. We wouldn't even be having this conversation. I wouldn't even consider the fact that he could possibly
be... You wouldn't
be
have taken the case.
Innocent.
Yeah.
No, if that was the case.
Yeah.
But the fact that that one single piece of physical evidence disappeared and was never mentioned at trial is... Yeah, that's the bigger problem. And then the fact that she didn't sign that page makes it even bigger.
Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Okay, so I'm going to read Heather M. posted a bunch of stuff. I think we've actually covered a lot of it just in this conversation. We talked about, she was looking for clarification on like the idea of Sheila not really knowing Liz, but still agreeing to go to the liquor store. And was it really about the liquor store? Did they even go to the liquor store? Was that just like code for we're going to go do something else? Or was the meet at the liquor store? And is the assumption that, you know, I think in the reality of what really happened, putting convicted Chris aside, is the assumption that they were going to meet someone at the liquor store and that is, in fact, who they ended up at the baseball field with.
I think, and that was where my frustration came in. It seems like, based on the parts of the statement that Michelle did sign, and Michelle doesn't have any reason to lie about this stuff, it seems like, yeah, she got a page. And we can even tie that in with what Tasha told us, right? That, you know, she would go out hustling, earn some money, and then she told her that she was going to, you know, she was relapsing. So she would be going to meet somebody to get drugs. So then when at 11, 12 o'clock at night, you go to the liquor store to meet somebody to buy drugs from, and then an hour and a half later, you're murdered. I can't say that's for sure the person that killed her, but it's a pretty damn good clue that, you know, that's a good place to start for sure. And speaking of, we keep talking about Sheila. Another thing that brought up, and I do mention it in Sunday's episode, but something that I didn't mention in the prosecutor's closing argument, and actually Chris's defense missed this really. I think this was a huge miss in his closing. Most of you guys have all heard Chris's statements, both of them, and you've heard, they're on the website, you can read them. The biggest glaring omission that everybody should be saying what the hell about, Sheila was found fully nude. Where in Chris's statement anywhere does he even act as though he knows that fact?
Yeah.
I mean, think of it. So the version, one version was that Shaky and Terrell leave with the two girls. He doesn't know what happened. The second version is he went there with Amp, and Amp shot one of them, came back, shot the other one. They drug him into the woods, dumped him. Nowhere in there is there any explanation for why Sheila's fully nude. Never comes up, not brought up by the state, and not brought up by the defense either. Like, that's a pretty big, glaring omission. If he's even trying to, like, minimize his role and say that it was Amp did it, that doesn't explain why you don't give those details then, right? You would tell a story that fits the evidence that you know because you were there. If you know Liz was nude when this happened, if you were actually there and you're trying to put the blame on somebody else, you say, well, Amp was attacking her and he took her clothes off and he raped her and then he did this, or you know, whatever thing you would say. But that would be a big part of your narrative. It doesn't even come up.
Yeah.
In Chris's narrative. This is something else to think about.
Yeah. That's an excellent point.
I just did a quick little look. The number that Chris gives as his home phone number is not the number that Michelle gives as the number that called.
Right. And that makes sense because their narrative is that he's, you know, at a payphone somewhere.
Correct.
Okay. Heather also was kind of talking about, like, victimology, but also kind of MO of the killers at the house, killer or killers at the house. Heather's just kind of postulating the idea of, like, is it possible that the drugs were actually, like, a way of making sure that if you have this plan to go in and essentially execute these people, that you are going to have them be distracted. There's something going on, like, that's the lulling the people into a sense of everything being fine, but also just a sense of, like, there is this activity that is happening that is distracting and that then allows you to commit a crime without having to worry at all that there's going to be, that you're going to get, you know, that you might get shot or that you might get hurt in some way.
Yeah, I've wondered a lot about, so I could tell you what kind of my hypothesis is about how this all shook out. I think, and again, this is just my hypothesis, but based on what we know so far and the timings and everything we know with the toxicology reports, I think that Liz went to the liquor store. I think probably she did maybe call Amp to get somebody's number, right? Because there's a connection to whoever this is with Amp, right? Because they went to the house. So I think she does call it to get Amp, and Amp's like, well, try calling this guy. She calls this guy, and they go and they meet, and I think they then went to Amp's house. That was the first visit that Larry, you know, said that night that he heard that happened, right? And they were there. Maybe they didn't have the drugs, or they were going to go get the drugs, and they were like, all right, well, we're going to go with them, and maybe they worked out some kind of, I don't know what happened there, but I think they left with the girls, and something broke bad at that baseball field. I can't even begin to wrap my brain around why they went to the field and why Sheila's nude and why, but clearly something broke down. It looks to me like Liz was putting up a fight and she gets hit over the head, shot, killed, and all that happened. And then I think you've got your two guys at the baseball field that are like, well, shit, everybody at the house knows we're with these two girls. They're going to find them dead. We're going to have to get rid of the witnesses. And then they go back to the house with drugs. I don't know. I wonder if it's MO, like, well, we can get them distracted with the drugs. I personally don't think that's it, because, you know, you've got people just laying around a room and you have guns. You can walk in and just start shooting them. I wonder if it's more hesitation, nervousness, right? Like if the plan is we need to get rid of these witnesses, let's go. And then they go in like, hey, and they use the fact that they have the drugs to get in the door, set everybody at ease, get everybody, you know, starting in, and maybe they're having to work up the nerve because maybe it's, if they don't, they obviously, the killer, I think, doesn't know Liz and Sheila, right? They had to get the number. Remember, that also, by the way, doesn't fit the whole stage narrative. But the, you know, she had to get their number from Amp. So that tells me the killer knows Amp. The killer doesn't know them. So whatever happens at the field happens in the spur of the moment. Now they got to go back and is planning to kill his friends. And that's what I think personally with the drugs. I think it was maybe just like working up the nerve, like they're nervous, we'll all smoke. That's just kind of the way that I see it. Just spitballing.
Yeah. I mean, I hear you on all that. I guess I'm just so confused by like the narrative of I'm looking for substance. I'm looking for a substance. I'm looking for drugs. I'm Liz. I am at my friend's house. I don't have this person's contact information already. So I have to call AMP to get this pager number. I call the pager number. I make some sort of a plan. And suddenly the plan, ostensibly with this person that I'm getting drugs from, and just thinking about the very, very limited amount of victimology that we have with Tasha and kind of talking about like, mm-hmm. no, she wouldn't. It wouldn't necessarily be that she would like go to do sex work in exchange for drugs. Suddenly you have this right. whole night unfolding where like two women who don't know each other go together to meet someone else. And those people take them, the people that they potentially don't know and who don't know each other, take them to the house, not to get drugs because those people aren't the dealers because they're going to come back with the drug. Like that's just so many steps. To like the difference between that and like, I'm going to go meet a dealer and get drugs with the money that I made earlier doing sex work and then I'll have my drugs. That's just very, very strange.
It is weird. But but for me, like, because you're right, this whole thing is odd. So I just keep pulling that thread, right? Like, so what could that mean? And again, I go back to Sheila's naked, right? And Chris or AMP, excuse me, was painted by the state as being like some drug dealer. He wasn't. He clearly was not. And I also, you remember several episodes back when we got the toxicology report, I said, I don't think that this killer was just some drug dealer. I think it was AMP's friend. So I don't think that he gave her the number of, and again, I know I keep saying this as always, I want to clarify. I'm just thinking out right. loud. I don't think that the person that she called that she was meeting was like, a dealer. I think it was a guy who knows a guy type of thing. Like this guy usually, maybe he's holding, he might be somebody who might be able to hook you up. And so I could see a scenario where if those, and it seems like it was at least two guys, if they, you know, then they go to AMPs and they're like, yeah, we don't have anything. And if these, I could see those guys. And you know what though? I do know another guy. And that's why they should have pulled AMPs phone records too. You know, let me go with this other guy and, you know, I'll take you girls. Here, we're going to go meet up with this other guy who's got it and we'll go get the drugs from, we're going to meet him at this baseball field. When really maybe the intention was to take the girls there and sexually assault them. Mm. And that breaks bad.
Mm-hmm.
And, or maybe they did meet another third party there at the ball field to get the drugs in there. But to me, that scene with Liz in particular just reads to me like an attempted forced sexual assault. You know, mm-hmm. it does not read to me that she was trading sex work for something. Mm-hmm. It seems to me like it was like they were being going to be assaulted there. That broke bad. And then they circle back. But the idea of their killers smoking with them doesn't read to me like a drug dealer. It reads to me like a friend.
OK. Yeah. Maliha, I think I'm hopefully saying your beautiful name right, Maliha. Says, I'm still so confused why Chris's lawyer did not call out Larry on Larry's testimony. Did he not have the first confession? Did he not? Maliha, I think maybe you're saying confession, but I think maybe you're saying Larry's statement. Yeah. Larry's statement of saying that he heard two voices.
Well, I'll give you, to answer the question, I'll give you a little prelude to Sunday's episode. Ultimately, what ends up happening for the defense case in chief is Graddick does recall Larry to try to get to the bottom of exactly that. And so you'll hear about that on Sunday.
Oh, great. Okay. Wish I would have saved that for the last question, but I didn't know what this next week was going to be. Katya says, was there any attempt by anyone in this case to find the other Chris? It appears people agree he exists based on Liz's phone note and based on what AMP told his brother. Do relatives know of any other Chris in Liz/AMP's circle of friends? Problem is, once the jury heard the word confession, that was it. It's very disheartening. I agree, Katya. And again, this is kind of what I was mentioning when we started talking about our listener questions this week, is just kind of coming back to this idea of like, you potentially had a huge lead that you could have really followed up on that wasn't the same Chris. What the
hell? So there's two answers to the question. Prior to the trial, did anyone look for the other Chris? No. After the trial, after the conviction, yes. And I actually, I'm working on now to figure out exactly. I've learned some of how that shook out. I'm trying to figure out right now how much of that I'm going to be able to share with you guys. All I can say about it right now, but as I think I've mentioned before, there is another Chris, but no one was looking for another Chris prior to the trial.
If you're that Chris and you are responsible, I hope you feel like the luckiest person alive, and I want you to know that your luck is going to change.
How much do I want? No, we'll wait.
The last couple are, this is funny, actually. I'm realizing that Ashley had very similar thoughts to me. And Ashley was also in our pregame live, and she and I also had similar thoughts in the pregame that had nothing to do with this case whatsoever. So Ashley and I are apparently sisters from another mister. I don't know. Yeah. But yeah, just kind of Ashley having the same questions about, like, what do you do about a confession that has a lot of holes in it or that could have a lot of holes poked in it? Like, how do you even approach that? On the stand, off the stand, how. So Ashley, I'm sorry that I once again snuck in and asked my question first, but we talked about that. And then Jordan says, since the case was so flimsy and the only thing they had against Chris was his confessions, and then obviously what Larry said as well, I'm just adding that, was Chris offered a plea deal? Were there any discussions with his lawyer about this to avoid going to trial altogether?
Yeah, so that, if you remember back, we talked a little bit about that in Chris's post-conviction testimony. So essentially, Chris said that he was offered a plea deal and his lawyer told him not to take it because he told him he was going to get the confession thrown out and they didn't have a case. Chris's lawyer then testified that, no, I didn't tell him that. I suggested that, if I remember correctly, I think basically he did the opposite of falling on his sword and went the other way. And it's like, no, I didn't screw up. I told him he should have taken the plea deal. But according to Chris, he kept telling him he was going to get the confession thrown out. So he wouldn't take the plea deal. He shouldn't take the plea deal. As I mentioned back then, it was kind of moot because, and I think that's why it failed in post-conviction relief, is because Chris also said, I was never going to take the deal. I wasn't going to confess. I wasn't going to plead guilty to something I didn't do. So it was like, well, whether he told you to or didn't tell you
you've
to.
You've just negated that because you said it wouldn't have made a difference.
Right.
Got it. I guess I forgot that he also said that even his own lawyer was like, that his own lawyer lied about conversations that they had.
Well, they had conflicting stories. I guess we can't know which one's lying.
He said that. Ooh, that's so hard. What a scary feeling. You feel like you're the only person. If indeed all of this happened the way that Chris says it did, it's just to be the, you feel like you're just on an island completely by yourself. That's terrifying.
And the frustrating part is that because we talked about this even in this season, we've talked about this, like one of the most difficult wrongful conviction cases to overturn is one where there was no evidence for the conviction, because the standards and the burdens put on the defense side in post-conviction work is you have to basically undo what the damage the state did. And it's like, all you can do is convince a judge. And again, because this wasn't recorded, because there's not a transcript, you can't have some false confession expert come in or anything like that. All they have is, here's where it's written out that you said you did it, and here's where you signed it. Like, how do you undo that? And I think the answer in Chris's case is it's going to take solving the case. And I think that's doable. I think it's going to take, maybe not. I've got some ideas. It's going to take some forensic work and some other things, but some of that stuff's already done. It's possible. I'll say that it is possible, but I think that's what it's going to take, unfortunately, in Chris's case. Unless, I'm really hoping that there's something to, if the defense can find that note somehow, which my understanding is it's been looked for and they claim it doesn't exist. It isn't anywhere. But if by some miracle, in some box, in some file somewhere, that note exists and it has someone else's phone number on it, that is the most massive Brady violation of all Brady violations. But even with that, it gets tough in a case like this because, again, here's the state playing chess. the state didn't claim at trial that it was Chris's number, which means you have to prove, if it's Brady, you have to prove that having that number would have changed the outcome of the trial, which then compares back to the actual trial testimony. So it's like, well, the jury convicted him without ever thinking it was his number. We never said it was his number. I think it's a flimsy argument, but that's probably the argument the state would make is, you know, how can you say if they only knew it wasn't Chris's number, they wouldn't have convicted when they didn't know it was Chris's number? It's I'll give them this. It's clever. It's clever the way they handled every bit of this, all the way from the interrogation through to the trial.
Well, that's what makes me think that note will never be found. That's just...
Yeah, that note is long gone.
Like, that's... it's hard to imagine it floating around somewhere since this feels pretty, like, buttoned up in terms of all the things that needed to be, you know.
That's one of the things that's so frustrating about our criminal justice system is, to me, there should be some level of relief. If you have proof, and we have proof, we have in the report, it says that note is attached. If you have proof that a piece of evidence existed and now the state claims it's gone, like there should be, and there is some case law for this. It's called the Youngblood decision. It's a Supreme Court decision with regards to DNA, where like if there was biological evidence and then that they knew existed, and then the defense wants to test the evidence, and then the state says, oh, well, it's gone. There are certain circumstances from that Youngblood decision. I think it was Youngblood. Where the Supreme Court ruled, well, then we will presume that it was beneficial to the defense then. If you lost it, then they get to say it wasn't him, essentially. So, I mean, it's obviously much more complicated than that, but it's something along those lines. But to me, like, there should be something like that for like this type of evidence. Like, it says the note exists. We don't believe it says what they said. Where's the note? It doesn't exist. Well, then they should get that presumption. But they don't. That's if I was king of the world, which I am not. And with that being said, since I've just realized I'm not the king of the world, it seems like a great time to end this very sad episode. So we're going to let you guys go for now. We will be back next week with another follow-up. I believe we'll be on Wednesday night next week. Is that right, Janet?
It could possibly be Tuesday. Sorry.
Yeah.
Let me find that out.
So pay attention to social media. Pay attention to social media. We'll let you know when we're going to be recording live. And for those of you that like to watch us live on YouTube, we'll make sure we let you know when that's going to happen. And make sure you tune in on Sunday. You're going to hear the entire defense case in chief and the defense's closing arguments. And then we'll talk all about that next week. We'll see you guys then.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found @bobrufftruth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.